Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky.
My guest is Diane Ackerman, whose latest book is An Alchemy of Mind, The Marvel and Mystery of the Brain. Earlier books include Cultivating Delight, Rarest of the Rare, Natural History of Love, Natural History of the Senses. There are, I believe at this point, 8 books in this series of literary nonfiction, 7 volumes of poetry, and several nature books for children, a PBS series.
I lose track of it.
And you do all this from Ithaca, New York, which is pretty remarkable.
And play with the roses in the garden.
These 8 books all deal with different themes. These are book-length essays. They're not nonfiction narratives as we come to know them. They're essays, very, very long, multi-part essays. How do you choose a subject?
What usually happens is that I wake up one day and I feel really stupid about something that I crave to know about. It may be, in this case, how the brain becomes the mind or something like that. And more and more I find myself reading about it, thinking about it. The world starts to become magnetized to the purpose of whatever that is. And then at some point it dawns on me that I'm coming down with a book. I almost never know ahead of time. I don't really plan them. It's something that creeps up on me. Or rather, it's at work in my subconscious and my unconscious. And at some point, the unconscious slips a little telegram under the door. And I know that that's what's going to be my romance for the next couple of years. But they really aren't different, I think. I think that all of my books, whether they're in poetry or prose, really are part of the same quest to understand how we came to be, what life is like on this particular planet, what it feels like and tastes like and hurts like and thrills like to be a human being, what the experience of being alive was all about.
Which was the first book?
The first book was a collection of poems called The Planets, A Cosmic Pastoral. And it's a suite of scientifically accurate, as opposed to, let's say, astrology, poems about the real planets. I had been listening to Gustav Holst's beautiful music about the planets. And I thought, the music is wonderful, but isn't it sad that we have to pretend that Venus is a goddess, and we have to pretend that Mars is a god, and we have to give them human qualities in order to find them full of wonder. Why don't we just find nature extraordinary, even especially alien nature? And I started learning more and more about the real planets and thought, I think maybe I need to combine the poet part of me with the part that is curious about the world. I had 3 choices after my undergraduate years. I was trying to decide among going to work at the Jane Goodall site in Tanzania and digging up earthquake victims in Peru with some people I knew, and going to grad school in creative writing. And I ultimately decided that that's what I would do. And it was as if somebody threw a switch and my life changed direction at that point. And I went to Cornell. I got a scholarship to do that. It happened that Carl Sagan was there. He wasn't very well known at the time, but I had read a book of his about the planets. I asked him to be a technical advisor on it, which he agreed to quickly. And so when I arrived there, I had a poet, A.R. Ammons, and a scientist, Carl Sagan, on my MFA and then my doctoral committee. And that really made it possible for me to work in both the arts and the sciences, and especially to start work on that first collection of interdisciplinary poems.
And the first essay, book-length essay?
The first nonfiction. We weren't really calling it creative nonfiction or literary essay.
I don't know
what we were calling it then. Was called Twilight of the Tenderfoot. And I had always been a horse girl. I had wanted to write an aesthetics of the horse, kind of prose poems. And I knew that there was a Cornell alumnus who owned a vast working cattle ranch in New Mexico. And I wrote to him and asked if I could sign on. And he found that amusing. And also, unbeknownst to me, they had no way to educate the kids on their ranch. They were so remote. They had a little trailer schoolhouse. And they thought it would be good to expose the kids to someone who was educated from the East and so on. And so there were many elements at work here, but I went out there and was there for each of the seasons and was delivering calves and cowboying and doing all of that stuff, and I just loved it. And that was really the first that I did. And then at some point, I wrote an essay about why we all feel grandeur when we go to the Grand Canyon, why people from all different cultures, different ages feel that. I published it in Harvard Magazine. It was read by some people who asked if I wanted to do something for Life Magazine on monarch butterflies that were had their overwintering sites endangered. One thing just led to another. And before I knew what happened, I was working with endangered animals and writing about them and doing things like that. The prose, it's a poet's prose.
When you're doing research and then you've got your own poetry and your own metaphors in the work you do, the combining of the two, how conscious is it?
Seems natural for me. There is no kind of checkpoint, Charlie, between which you have the sciences on the one hand and
right.
and nature on the other hand. It's all nature to me. Even when I was writing The Planets, Carl Sagan was very open to exploration wherever, whatever field it was in. But there were people in the humanities who weren't. And I had somebody say to me, what's a nice girl like you doing writing about amino acids? You know, that was not thought to be the proper realm of literature at the time. But for me, I was a nature poet, and this was part of nature. So, yes, I do the research because I find the real world fascinating. I don't require that it be something else. But while that is happening, not really separate, I have all of my normal or neurotic or everyday human responses to things, and I have my poet's responses to things, and it all happens pretty much at the same time.
I noticed in reading Cultivating Delight and Alchemy of Mind, there's a combination of research and doing. And in Alchemy of Mind, while you didn't actually do things specifically for this, we have the entire story of how you fell off a cliff, I guess, in researching another book.
Yes. Remind me never to do that again. I was going to go see some of the last remaining short-tailed albatrosses. If you care, they're not really short-tailed. They have long legs.
How big are they?
They have wingspans that go up to like 5 feet. And I mean, they're huge birds.
And where was this?
This was on a little island 600 kilometers south of Tokyo. And you have to go there in monsoon season, and, you know, there's shark-infested waters, and it's an uninhabited island, and nobody goes there. And you have to work your way down the islands and get on a fishing vessel. In other words, it was a quest, a really wonderful quest, to see these last remaining beautiful endangered birds. And I went there with two gentlemen who are ornithologists, unbeknownst to me, lifelong rock climbers. In retrospect, they should have told me that there was going to be some rock climbing involved, and I could have done some upper body strengthening. But I didn't know that. I just discovered on the spot that we were going to be hiking across an active volcano. That part I knew, but not that we were going to have to be lowering ourselves down 400-foot cliffs to see the albatrosses, who had survived because they lived in a fortress of stone that nobody could get to. I slipped and broke 3 ribs. Not a good thing to do. It was monumentally painful. I couldn't move the top half of my body. I was still thrilled to be there seeing the albatrosses, and my colleagues dug a pit in the volcanic sand for me, and I couldn't get up or sit down by myself. I couldn't go to the bathroom by myself. I couldn't do anything. So they lowered me into it, and when it came time to go, they hoisted me back up the cliff. One person had a rope on top, and the other was just lifting me haunch by haunch. And then we had to go across the volcano again. The next day they left me in a cement barracks that was abandoned during the war, while they went to see the albatrosses, and I started running a really high fever.
And that's when you hallucinated an angel who happened to be somebody on a fishing boat.
Thank God.
You talk about leaving. Did you leave a note for the guys? I hope.
Somebody showed up. I didn't know if it was a hallucination or a real person. It turned out to be a man who was part of that team. And what I did was just gesture that I had something broken inside. And I knew enough Japanese to say, ahodori, albatross. And I wrote a note. The kind of note that you would find in something like The English Patient, you know, the kind of don't let me die here all alone note. And the person found the men, one of whom ran back and showed up at the door looking like he had just come down a birth canal. He and the woman from the boat, and it really was just my good luck that there was a fishing vessel privately chartered, that had shown up, and she had decided she would climb for a view, you know, that kind of thing, that they had found me, and they got me onto the boat and off the island. I was running a very high fever that I couldn't bring down, and it was just because the inflammation was so great. But in truth, there's nothing you really do with broken ribs.
You just kind of wait to heal them.
That's right, and it takes about 3 months.
That was not the time you broke your back. When did you break your back?
I didn't break my back. I've had a broken neck.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Yes, I was in a neck collar with a broken neck while I was writing the gardening book, Cultivating Delight. And nonetheless, that was a bicycle accident. But it was really some of the happiest time in my life because I did two things. I listened to Virginia Woolf, Unabridged, everything on tape that was available because I couldn't tilt my head down very well. And that was wonderful to borrow her sensibility. And also because I would get up each morning and just rub my hands together and say, what am I going to learn about nature today? And I was learning about the garden.
But you couldn't go out into your garden.
I could go out into it. I just had to be really careful.
Let's talk a little bit, Diane Ackerman, about an alchemy of mind. Was there a specific thing, or was it just this general accumulation that got you started moving away from gardens and animals and into the human mind?
I think it was, if not the next logical step, one that I had been thinking about for a very, very long time. I've written about the dark night of the soul in one of the books, and I've written about our relationship with other animals and natured, and how we are really the rarest of the rare. And I've written about the senses and about love. And I'm trying to put together a mosaic of the human condition, I think. And we are both trapped and privileged to be in this wonderful rut of having our brain. And it's the only way we can know the world. But it's also an extraordinary way, unlikely way to know the world, very much like all the other animals, and yet different in some important ways, too. We are uniquely ordinary, and I've just always been fascinated by mind.
We divide the mind into brain and mind, into the somatic versus, I guess you'd call it, the psychological. In my old psychology classes that I took years ago, the problem was that somatic works if you just deal with the brain, and psychological works if you just deal with the mind.
Of
it's an amazing
course.
Thing.
We are both mind and matter. There's no difference that they can detect when they do brain scanning between people who have improved because of drug taking and people who have improved because of psychotherapy. Same effect if you do them both together. Excellent. If you are standing outside of yourself, if somebody's looking at you, consciousness is physical. You are all physical. But from the inside, it's all mental, which is part of the reason that there really is not a mind-body problem and why it's so very hard to understand what somebody else is going through. We have personalities like everybody else. We have many, many selves that we share with other people's many, many selves. But we are all unique anyway because we've grown up in such very different environments. We've had different families. We've had different experiences. When I was in high school, I thought I would go into physiological psychology. And when I got to college, by mistake, the computer put me in English. But I just stayed interested in the mind.
In trying to understand the mind, the brain, and trying to get a sense of it, in essence, we're trying to create order out of a certain chaos. And in looking at my notes for Cultivating Delight, that's exactly what the garden is about.
Oh, yes. But we do this all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we obsessively tidy our desk before we start a new project. We live in really peculiar places, you know, our houses, the way we order them. So much of the world is chaotic. There is so much sensory overload, and we add to it in ways that are absolutely new and we need to question sometimes. And we filter out so much of life. What we want to do is bring some kind of order. We just want to survive. And to survive, we need vivid memories about what happened to us and what could be useful right now in problem solving. And we need powerful emotions that will make us want to find sweethearts and create offspring. And we need to be able to find food and different things. So we need to bring some sense of order, however slight, to our world, and we all have different ways of doing it.
Now, where does the Manichaean impulse come in, the idea of, it's not merely right and left brain, but this idea of bifurcation, if you're not one, you're the other. Some of us see things in shades of gray, but some people, it's all black or white.
Yeah, some people really are heavily weighted towards one side of the brain or the other.
And so you think there's a direct correlation between that and the sides of the brain?
I think that most people combine efforts from both sides, but there's no doubt that the left has certain chores and the right side has certain chores, and that each side has evolved to dilute the other. And if you have an injury on one side, then the other side is totally unbridled, and you can suddenly have somebody who was a really mild-mannered person who becomes savage and angry and depressed because there isn't that other side that's quieting things down. It turns out that men's and women's brains are very different, wired differently, and that men, since we're talking about sides of the brain, that men tend to solve problems by focusing on it with whichever side of the brain makes the most sense for it, and women tend to recruit many different parts of the brain, and that women have more connections in their neurons than men do, but also more connections between the hemispheres, so that it's as we always suspected. When you're fighting about something that seems to be very specific, women, more often than not, will bring in lots of other stuff at the time. There's good reason for that, a good physical reason. The plus for that, for women anyway, is that whereas men have this fight and flight instinct that has served men really well, women have a tend and befriend instinct going on too. And they've needed that because they could not risk hurting themselves physically to the same extent that men could because they had offspring that they had to look out for. So we take all of this for granted now, or it's just submerged right in our society, but there have been good evolutionary reasons why it's happened.
You're listening to an interview with Diane Ackerman, whose latest book is An Alchemy of Mind. If you were to take a Republican's mind and a Democrat's mind and cut them in half, conceivably, could you see a somatic difference?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. All I can tell you is that I'm going to go out in November and I'm going to vote early and often. Yeah, probably you could. But the problem here is that nature and nurture are so intimately interwoven that it's very hard to determine what's what. For example, we do come into the world with a lot of things inherited, but so much of the brain is unfinished, completely immature in so many ways, or we wouldn't be able to give birth, that the brain has to get all programmed and thatched up in those very early years, and therefore the environment, and I mean even the womb environment, what's happened to mom during that time, is she being stressed, is she growing up in an area where there's a lot of racism, is she growing up in an area where there's a lot of abuse, you know, what's happening, and what the child encounters, the sentiments, the habits, the prejudices of the parents and everything, all of that gets ingrained. And even before kids have language, they are able to respond to, and their brains can respond to, what is happening around them. So let's say that a female child is born, and when it's 1 day old, it follows faces more than males do, which is, in fact, what happens. All right, well, that elicits a different kind of relationship with the parents than a little boy would, just by virtue of that, and the little girl then responds to that, and let's say mom responds to that, and you have this interaction going on. So you get born into this world with some things installed in your personality and your predilections. You acquire some, and you can change them over the course of your life depending on what you see and what happens to you.
Now, if we move into the area of sexuality and gender, if what you're saying is true, then the arguments over nature versus nurture, changing a person's sexual orientation, things like that, I mean, where does that all fit in? Because it all comes down at that point to something so chaotic, you can't put a finger on it.
You can't. But you can get that finger mighty close to it. I think sexual orientation has a very profound biological basis. I think it has a lot to do with with what is going on in the womb during especially the third trimester, you know, whether the mom has experienced a lot of stress and therefore has more cortisol going around in the body, the different hormones and stuff like that. We can have all different kinds of orientation that we inherit tendencies towards, but we can also have a lot happen to us in womb time. And there's not a lot of attention paid to that. It's interesting, especially if you look at twin studies, also, where one twin may be gay and the other not. Now, what's that about? Didn't they grow up in the same household? Didn't they have the same genes and so on?
Weren't they in the same womb?
Weren't they in the same womb? So there are also other factors that can play into this. But it does seem like there's an awful lot of evidence for biological things going on, some of which people are just beginning to do the studies on now. For example, they're finding that pregnant women who have had extreme stress, let's say they're in war, during that third trimester, if they are going to have boys, are more likely, statistically, greatly more likely, to have boys who become gay. So why is that? There's something happening hormonally at that point. I find all of that fascinating.
Let's move on. Keep in the same general region and move on to creativity and intelligence. Is it kind of the same thing involving trimester, or is it something else?
In the case of creativity, also, it's nature-nurture. All of these issues are. Just genetically speaking, there have been a lot of studies done with creative people in the United States and in France and in England, and they have a gigantically larger incidence of alcoholism, depression, and other kinds of things. So is that genetic? Are they genetically predisposed? Probably. But then in addition to that, if you think about it, art is a really inherently unstable lifestyle. You're going to be experiencing extremes of emotion professionally. You're going to be seeing things that other people don't see, so you're going to be feeling isolated and marginalized. You have to be more sensitive than other people. You probably are holding down at least two full-time jobs and being paid badly for both of them. You know, there are just so many elements that don't make for a very stable lifestyle anyway that could drive you to drink. I think that if you look at the lives of, let's just say, writers, really creative writers, who were also alcoholics or took drugs, you discover that their work was done despite the alcoholism. It wasn't done largely during the alcoholism. It didn't make their work better, being alcoholics. That was something they had to deal with, and that it most often was in the periods when they were not alcoholics or when they could keep it at bay that they were able to do their profound works, because it's very distracting.
But on the other hand, the alcoholism in that sense is also a symptom of the artist as well.
It is also a symptom. That's correct. And then sometimes they had family circumstances which led them to have to dissociate in different ways, create alternate worlds, learn to outthink their parents because there was abuse, so they would have to read faces really well, read subtleties of emotion really well. And that's excellent training for acting, for writing, for anything. So there are, again, many nature-nurture ingredients. It doesn't follow just because you inherit the genes for something that you're going to become that.
And on the other hand, how many people follow in their parents' footsteps even if they don't intend to?
Even if they don't intend to. But also, it's good news that you can be, by birth, very short, but maybe turn out to be a decent basketball player if you're really determined. And you can be very tall and just really have no interest at all in it. And the same is true across the board.
Memory. What is lemon balm?
Lemon balm is a wonderful herb that you can grow in your garden. Sometimes it's called Melissa. If you like Knipe Botanicals, they call it Melissa. It helps stimulate the brain cells.
Can you find it in a health food store or something?
You sure can, and you can grow it. It's more fun to grow it because you can make lemon balm tea, and it's not as pungent as verbena, verbena, and verbena leaves, which I love, feel a little raspy to play with, and lemon balm are very soft and furry to play with. So there are different sensory reasons for growing both of them. But they're good for your brain, and so is blueberry. The first thing I did when I got to San Francisco was go to Whole Foods and get 6 pints of organic blueberries and some blackberries and strawberries because they're very good for the brain.
Ginkgo biloba has all the press. What do you think
of that? It does have all the press, but it's also partly a blood thinner, and that's why I don't take it. You know, it has press, but who knows how well it really works. There are other things that have press, too, that are herbal. I just think it's safer to be dealing either with those or with serious antidepressants that you go to a doctor who is monitoring you and you have prescribed for you. And now I'm thinking especially of the ones that involve serotonin, because if you are depressed, seriously depressed, there is some evidence that the part of your brain that has to do with memory shrinks. But the serotonin drugs increase the connections among the neurons. That's a good thing. So you can offset it a little bit. At least I think you can.
Diane Ackerman, now it's been, what, a year since you finished Alchemy of Mind, about?
Yes, about that.
What you leave out that you wish had gone in?
Well, I've kept pretty much up to date on stuff, but there are so many new ways of dealing with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all of those things that are such terrible burdens. I met someone yesterday at a reading who was severely handicapped, and he said he regarded his handicap as an art form, that it allowed him to see the world in a very specialized way that other people didn't. Well, those kinds of stories are really amazing, too. It goes to show you how resourceful human nature is, how one can make the most of whatever circumstance one finds oneself in. Maybe I would have included a few more of those.
Diane Ackerman, have you begun gestating something new?
Yes, I have. But I'm not really going to talk about it, except to say that it's very much natural history. I love nature. I love the excuse to spend time absorbing nature. It's part of my earth ecstasy religion that I practice on a daily basis. I'm the only one in this temple, and the creed is very simple. I believe that all life is sacred, and that human beings have the ability to act better towards one another.
You've been listening to an interview with Diane Ackerman, whose latest book is An Alchemy of Mind. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.